This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, a major healthcare announcement for the regional hospital complex. We'll hear about Nova Scotia Power's Makerspace facility, and on The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall, author Michael Gearhartz. All coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. Last week, the provincial health minister came to town to announce some major funding for healthcare infrastructure at the regional healthcare complex. The minister made the announcement along with local healthcare officials at the Member 2 Trade and Convention Center. Here is a sampling of some of the speakers that day.
So at this time, I would like to call upon our MLA for Sydney Whitney Pier, Minister of Energy and Mines, Derek Mumbriquet, for the official welcome.
Good morning, everyone. I want to start by recognizing that we are in Mi'kma'ki, the traditional and unceded territories of the Mi'kmaq people. So I want to thank Member 2 for hosting the community here today. I'm very honored to be here with my colleagues, Minister DeLory and Minister McClellan as well. I know I see MLAs Alfie McLeod, Eddie Orrell, and Tammy Martin, and Keith Bain, are here as well. So I appreciate you being here today. For the announcement, I know there are a number of councillors that are here, CBRM councillors that are also here in the room, so I also want to recognize their presence with us today. I want to thank Dr. Orrell and all of the leadership team for the work that they've done to get us to this point today. Many hours, many days of local leadership have been involved in making these decisions to enhance the healthcare that our community deserves. So to you, Dr. Orrell, and to your entire team, on behalf of the community, thank you very much for your work. I'm excited to be here with my colleagues, both Minister DeLore and Minister McClellan. As a government, we are committed to ensure that we have infrastructure that represents the best needs for healthcare in the community for years to come. Minister DeLore, I'm very proud to be your friend and to be here with you today. So at this point now, I would offer the floor to you. Thank you.
This is an important project, an infrastructure initiative for Cape Breton Regional Municipality Healthcare Redevelopment Project. It really is about transforming the way that healthcare is delivered. It's about providing the infrastructure that's needed to ensure that transformation can take place. This is a huge project. It's a huge project. It means a lot of change. This change and this initiative is impacting four communities in the Cape Breton region, and it's going to impact those communities, and a lot of work has been happening under the leadership of people within TIR, frontline healthcare professionals, the Nova Scotia Health Authority, working in communities, having meetings with the frontline staff. We know that work has been taking place in New Waterford, North Sydney, and Glace Bay, but today, and what we're going to be doing in as the work progresses there, we'll be going to those communities to provide those updates. For today, we are providing an update about what's happening for Cape Breton Regional Hospital. So that's the focus of today's announcement, is on the changes that are coming as part of the Cape Breton Healthcare Redevelopment Project at the Cape Breton Regional Hospital. There have been a number of renovations that have taken place over the years at Cape Breton Regional. What we've done when we made our announcement was that we knew that we were going to be need to expand the emergency department. We need to expand the cancer center. We knew we needed to do work in our critical care sector in that facility. One of the first times that I came to Cape Breton Regional Hospital over a year ago, one of the most notable stops on that tour was the emergency department. And meeting with those healthcare professionals on the front line, what they told me was how not just the amount of space was insufficient, but that the design and the structure and the layout of that space was also inadequate for delivery of emergency healthcare services. They made it very clear to me at that time that ad hoc renovations to the emergency department would not be sufficient to meet the needs of emergency healthcare delivery in that hospital. So as the team went out and has been over the last number of months meeting with healthcare professionals, to evaluate how to best implement the expansions that were needed to deliver healthcare to this hospital going forward. What has come back and what we've decided to move forward on is a new build, added out almost 190,000 square feet of space on the back of the existing Cape Breton Regional Hospital. This new space will provide the home for a new emergency department that is double the size of the current emergency department. A new cancer center is being developed there that will provide the services to the growing number of cancer patients in this community. And it is also providing new space for critical care units. And the critical care unit provides coronary care, intensive and intermediate care units. This new build for critical care will almost triple the size of the existing space for those units that are currently available in the Cape Breton Regional Hospital. This significant investment and building means that we will have infrastructure at Cape Breton Regional Hospital to provide emergency care, critical care, and cancer care beyond what is currently able to be delivered in that space. This is about providing the care for today and into the future. So I'm very excited about the ability to provide this care and this new development. We know that not just will this space be important, but the design, the layout, and the equipment that goes along with it will ensure that our healthcare professionals can deliver the care that's needed to Cape Bretoners. We know with the expansion in in cancer care that they'll be able to provide more care as well to people in Cape Breton. They'll be able to provide more research and clinical trial opportunities. And so one last piece of benefit of doing this as a new build off of the back as opposed to renovations inside the existing building is that it's less disruptive. It's less disruptive to healthcare workers that are providing care today, and it's less disruptive to those patients that are in the hospital receiving the care. So this next step is starting now. We have the request for proposal. We'll be going out for design and build of the new building, going out this week. We don't want to slow down this important piece of work, so we expect, as the design work takes place, that we will do site preparation work throughout the summer, and we'd expect to see, after the design, that full construction of the site begins by next summer. We've already approved about $8 million to continue this work, and we'll continue to approve funding as the project and design work continues. This is exciting progress for Cape Breton's largest healthcare infrastructure project. It is transformational, and it will provide the infrastructure and space and the tools for healthcare professionals to provide the care that Cape Bretoners need for generations to come. I want to thank the many people on the front line who have been supporting this work, providing their input that allowed us to come to the decisions, the points that we've come to today, so that we look forward to their continued support as we continue the work for the overall Cape Breton regional healthcare development. Thank you very much.
Next, I'd like to introduce Dr. Brake. He's a medical director for ICU and certainly very involved in the critical care team.
Well, good morning. Thank you for coming. I've been here for 21 years. I try my best to serve this community, this beautiful community. And by community, I mean the entire island of Cape Breton, which really is my mandate. The intensive care unit at the Cape Breton Regional Hospital is the only ICU on this island. And so we serve all communities. And so what's good for the ICU here in Sydney is good for the entire island and for every community. The ICU as it exists right now is the same as it existed in 1995 when the doors of the hospital first opened. The needs of the community, the needs of our ICU have changed over the last 24 years. We have more patients now than we have beds. And that impacts patient care and impacts patients' families. On any given day, we have patients backed up in our emergency departments. Our ICU no longer meets the current standards. I don't mean our ICU care, I mean the actual physical space. A number of years ago, the Society of Critical Care Medicine published what should be an intensive care unit, and our unit does not meet those standards. The rooms are small, they're not private. We don't have proper anterooms, and that has huge impact in terms of privacy, confidentiality, and infection control. Recognizing this a number of years ago, several of my colleagues, we began to lobby for a new and better intensive care unit. We have been trying to make the case to anybody that will listen for at least 5 years. We put together proposals, and we have finally reached the point that I feel that we have been heard, at least from the intensive care unit standpoint. This intensive care unit will meet the standards. They'll meet all the current standards, and in fact, it will exceed the standards. And I feel, from my perspective, as an intensive care provider, I feel this is a good thing for our community and for our island. This intensive care unit serves everybody in Cape Breton. And we now have the potential to have an intensive care unit which is state-of-the-art. I would say it will probably be the best intensive care unit in Nova Scotia by the time we're finished this. And this is a monumental day for us. I'd like to thank everybody that's been involved in the process. Dorothy McCaskill, Paul McDonald, and also like to thank Dr. Ward Patrick, who's the head of critical care for the province of Nova Scotia, who's been instrumental in this. And so, again, I think this is a good day for us. I'd like to turn the microphone now over to Valerie Nugent, who's going to speak with respect to the cancer care proposal.
Thank you, Dr. Brake. Well, what a great day for cancer care in Cape Breton. This is so exciting. I've been in healthcare 35 years, and this is one of the biggest announcements I've been so proud to be part of. Given a cancer diagnosis, it's terrifying. Terrifying for patients and their families. The greatest gift we can give to our patients and our community is to bring care close to home. And today's announcement has done just that. So thank you very much for that. I would also like to say, with this new space and this redevelopment and this new standalone state-of-the-art building, we are going to be able to expand our clinical trials and research, and you've heard that a few times being stated. It's really important that our patients in Cape Breton have access to leading-edge, cutting-edge treatments and technologies that perhaps were not available prior to this. So that's very exciting because that improves outcomes for our patients. And any time we can improve patient care and outcomes, that is huge in cancer care. I would like to thank the team, the Cancer Center team, led by Chris Hillier and Troy Penny. Chris, can you stand, please, just for a moment? Chris has done a remarkable amount of work. Chris and I started this project 6 years ago, and we had a vision for cancer care. And today, this vision is becoming a reality. We've worked extremely hard, and the team, led by Chris, and he's got many team members with him, they worked hard, and they lobbied hard. And today, I feel that we've reached a milestone, and thank Minister DeLory for that. It's a huge investment in Cape Breton, a huge investment in cancer care. And any time we build a state-of-the-art building like this, where we can offer innovation, research, and clinical trials, we will attract the best of clinicians, and that is important for us here in Cape Breton. So I want to thank all of you who were part of this, and I want to thank government for this investment in Cape Breton. We are very proud in cancer care. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Brad Jacobs. I'm the CEO of the Cape Breton Regional Hospital Foundation. Ministers, Cape Breton Healthcare Redevelopment Team, donors, volunteers, and guests who are here today, it's an absolute honor for us to be here with you. On behalf of the Board of Directors of the Cape Breton Regional Hospital Foundation, I want to say how thrilled we are about this opportunity that's in front of us. And I know I see some of our board members here today. Stan McDonald, our incoming board chair, David Huntington, our treasurer, Brian Purchase, one of our board directors, and this group of people who are incredibly dedicated and passionate about the volunteer work that they do are really excited about this project. Along with our board and Michael Kellaway, who couldn't be here today, who's the chair of our advocacy committee, we have been working hard to get ready to partner on a significant project like this for quite some time. And so we are extremely excited to be here today, and I think we found a big capital project to support. As an organization that's raised more than $50 million, our donors have demonstrated their significant interest in cancer care. In 1998, in fact, when the Cancer Center was built, it was our donors in the community here in Cape Breton that donated half of the money. Again, in 2009, our donors funded a $5.5 million project to renovate and expand and provide equipment for that cancer center. More recently, in 2016, our donors provided $1 million for a linear accelerator, which is providing radiation therapy for 35 patients a day. And these projects have all been done in partnership with the provincial government and with the Nova Scotia Health Authority. So our donors are incredibly passionate about having an impact on cancer care. And I'm absolutely thrilled on behalf of our foundation and our board and our staff team to be able to stand here today and announce that the Cape Breton Regional Hospital Foundation will be launching a multi-year, multi-million dollar capital campaign to support this project. I'd like to thank all of our ministers who are here today in the front row and throughout the audience for supporting this project. I'd like to thank the Cape Breton Healthcare Redevelopment Team. And folks, I can tell you from being around these people every day, you have some of the best people in Canada who are planning and delivering healthcare right here at home in Cape Breton. And I couldn't be more excited to partner with you. Our foundation is here to support you every step of the way, and we're excited about following the work that's going to happen in this project and launching a multi-year, multi-million dollar campaign to support this great work. I'd like to now ask Dr. Orle to come back up to provide some more remarks.
So as a member of this team, I was very privileged to represent what I feel are the concerns of the doctors and surgeons who practice in Cape Breton. I have always attempted to obtain a position of leadership and to lobby for the healthcare that we deliver during my 30 years of orthopedic practice. I've done this in the shadow of giants, and you've heard from Dr. Brake, who has brought our ICU to the excellent point it is now, and you can hear the happiness he has in recognizing this new facility as being very important to his ongoing practice for critical care. The difficulty over the years has been that we've had trouble recruiting people, and it is facilities like this that will increase our ability to obtain more doctors to come to the island, which of course is badly needed. Dr. Paul McDonald has been a pioneer for cardiovascular health and care and delivery, and Paul is here today, and he has been an integral part of the physician co-leads who recognize that change like this is going to be very significant for his practice and his ability to further recruit specialists from his point of view. The cancer care team provide a service that is unequaled in our province and perhaps in other parts of Canada as well, because they keep people on the island and they prevent so much travel and so much distress at a time when people are suffering so badly. So we have some very good news here, and the clinicians and the people that have been advisory to the redevelopment project have become very enthusiastic about how this first step to improve our healthcare delivery is going to proceed. There will be many other stages to the project. The project is huge, it's costly, it's going to take time, but this first step is a very significant event for Cape Breton and the delivery of healthcare and our ability to recruit and to bring people into our system to help us do our work. At this time, I would like to call upon Minister McClellan to wrap up for us.
Thank you, Dr. Orrell. Thank you for your participation here today and for all the work that you've done with the redevelopment team. Dr. Brake, of course, Valerie, Brad, for your comments, and the rest of the platform guests, and of course, my friends Randy and Derek for being here today and being part of this. Ladies and gentlemen, this is it's been a long road to get to today, and there's a lot of road left. And I know the frustrations, we hear it all the time. I know, I hear, sorry, so look, ladies and gentlemen, we do hear it all the time, every day. We understand the magnitude for us as a government, for Derek, for Randy, for myself. Being here in Cape Breton, we appreciate how this is all important. This is the number one issue that we have. And I know the frustrations, and we hear it, we feel it. And you can feel it in this room and every discussion that we have. And I know that this lands on the politicians, but remember, there's incredibly talented, incredibly committed medical staff here, people who give their lives to be here. And ladies and gentlemen, if you just take a chance, for those in the front, look at what we have, look at what we're doing here today. This is the medical community. It should have been done, but it's being done now. Ladies and gentlemen, it's well over $100 million just here today. It's half $1 billion that we'll invest in Cape Breton. So, in any event, it is frontline people, ladies and gentlemen, who are making the decisions. They are the leaders. This isn't politicians making these decisions. It's the professionals. And no one understands that more than the local medical staff guys. That they get it, and they're the ones that are leading this conversation. So I just want to say that it's been a challenging road. There's no doubt about it. But we're getting there, and these investments are important. They'll happen quickly. They'll change the landscape for Glace Bay, for New Waterford, for the North Side, and for the regional hospital. This matters. It means a lot. This is a legacy piece. This isn't about a current government. This is about our province moving forward, ladies and gentlemen. This is the way that it has to be. We have to get in a different direction, and we're going to get there, and I'm proud of what we're doing here today. This is going to change the lives for a lot of people that we all know and love, our local people. This isn't about government and politics and votes. This is about health care, and this is going to make a major difference for all of us moving forward. So again, I want to thank the doctors for being here today and for all of you for being here. This is an important first step, ladies and gentlemen, and we're getting there. Thank you very much. We'll be right back.
It's called the Nova Scotia Power Makerspace, and it recently opened in the New Dawn Center for Social Innovation in North End, Sydney. The facility is funded by Nova Scotia Power, along with $300,000 from the federal government. The Makerspace is managed by InnovaCorp. Bobby Knock spoke with InnovaCorp's Bob Pelly and Stuart Wynot, who's the senior plant manager at Nova Scotia Power's Lingan Generating Station.
Well, I want to start off, I guess either of you can jump in on this one. What is a makerspace?
I'll start with that, Stuart. A makerspace is a, I'll call it a workshop. If any of you are older, like I am, when you went to junior high school, they had an industrial arts program.
Right.
It's really akin to that. So it's a place that has tools, equipment, training. Our particular makerspace has tools in woodworking, metalworking, robotics, electronics, and 3D printing, something that wasn't around when I was in high school, but is pretty popular today.
And who's your target audience? Who would want to use a space like this?
We're really looking at people who are interested in building prototypes or trying to invent new products. The space is open to anybody who has interest in building or making a project, but our intent is to provide programming, support, and assistance to people who are trying to build a product that they want to sell and bring to the global market.
And Mr. Wynot, how did Nova Scotia Power get involved with this project?
It was a combined effort from being the government and dealing with the InnovaCorp and Bob's group. And, we like to invest and build the economies in Nova Scotia. This was a very good project that we wanted to get involved with. And so we at Nova Scotia Power decided to invest $250,000 over the next 3 years. And I might add that's, is being paid for by the AmeriShare shareholders, so not impacting the local Nova Scotia Power customer. And we're interested in building the economy, and we feel that there's potential here to create jobs, and entrepreneurs get an opportunity to not have to make a major investment in equipment to be able to do that.
And how is Amera benefiting from this potentially? I mean, I guess if the economy is growing, I guess there's more people buying power potentially and so on. Is that the thinking there? Or?
Absolutely, and we want to contribute to individuals and create growth, not only for our own personal benefit, but for the benefit of all in Nova Scotia.
Mr. Pelly, tell me some of you already touched on some of the equipment that's available in this space. A 3D printer, that's, as you say, that's something that probably wasn't around in our day. But tell me, what kind of state-of-the-art equipment do we have here?
I'll touch on the 3D printers first, because there are three of them, and they each have different capabilities. One of them would be, if you compare them to, say, a printer you might have attached to your computer for printing documents, you can get them that are fast with not such high resolution.
Right.
You can get them that are really high resolution, but they might be a bit slower. And you can also get them that will print in different sizes, so one that will do larger format printing. And that's the same with the 3D printers that we have. So we have one that's low resolution but high speed, one that will do things a little bit larger in a what I would call a medium resolution, and then one that is high resolution that if you were looking to do a final prototype before you started conversion to, say, metal fabrication, you'd want that high resolution image. And one of the printers also, you can swap out the materials, so you can have combined, whether it's resin and carbon fiber, so you can really really play with the materials that you're using to impact what you're actually designing. So that's 3D printing. Robotics and electronics are again fairly high end. Our goal, we did a lot of consultation with folks at CBU and NSCC, and what we wanted to do was have equipment that was available that would be beyond the ability of what somebody might have in their garage or in their own shop, but not quite what you would find, say, at NSCC. So you're going to get a good quality, will allow you to do projects that you couldn't do at home, but also a progression. If you needed something really specific and specialized, we can help point you to where you could get that additional equipment. The in addition to the robotics and electronics, we've got the software for design, so the CAD/CAM design software to help you get set up and get rolling, and then also the actual machines that would do the machining, both automated as well as manual versions of those machines, and the expertise to teach you how to use the machines, how to do things safely, and guidance and support to help you get things done.
So there is staff there that can help people in using this equipment? And
Absolutely. Both staff as well as what we refer to as mentor members. So people who are experts in, you know, if it's CNC machining, for example, we've got people who have years of experience who not only have they helped us set up and fine-tune the installation of the equipment, they'll be using it themselves, and they'll be available to help people with projects on an as-needed basis.
So it is possible, and for if I have a business idea, I could make a prototype at this makerspace to present to, I guess, investors or what have you.
Absolutely, that's the whole intent. That's exactly what we're trying to achieve.
Now, I guess we need to talk about a little bit about cost. What does it cost to, if you want to use the makerspace? I think I saw there's a schedule of different costs, or there's individual memberships and some discounts, memberships and so on.
That's right, yeah. It's essentially set up almost like a gym membership. So, you know, at a gym, you don't need to have, you don't need to own all of that equipment yourself. You can get a membership, whether that's monthly, quarterly, or annually, and you can come in and you can access the equipment and materials that are there. As you mentioned, there's a variety of rates. I'm going from the top of my head, I believe it's approximately $50 a month is sort of the base. The full schedule of rates are available on the website. There are some special rates for seniors and partners of the facility. So if you're a member of the Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design, for example, they're a partner organization. They get access to some preferred rates, as do some of the other member organizations. If you're a resident in the New Dawn Center for Social Innovation, for example, seniors, veterans, and some other groups.
And if someone's interested, how do they get in touch?
They can actually drop into the site, which is at the New Dawn Center for Social Innovation, the former Holy Angels High School in the north end of Sydney, 37 Nepean Street. It's in the former gymnasium, and you can drop in, have a visit, get some safety orientation, and you know, see what we have to offer. You can also have a look at the InnovaCorp website. It's innovacorp.ca, and if you click on Acceleration Initiatives, and you'll see Nova Scotia Power Makerspace is one of the options, and it'll give you the full overview of pricing, what we have to offer, and you can even sign up for some of the safety orientation sessions that are in place that you need to have before you can actually become a member.
Okay, for using some of this equipment and
Absolutely.
So on.
Absolutely. Yeah. Safety is critically important for us.
Mr. Wynot, I want to perhaps give you the last word there. Nova Scotia Power is funding this over 3 years. What do you hope to see at the end of 3 years from this project? What is the goal?
I guess at the end of the day, we would like to be able to say that we supported this this good cause, and that there's actually new businesses that have been created or expanding current business and has created employment for Nova Scotians and Cape Bretoners.
Time now for The Good Sentence with Paul McDougall. This week, Paul speaks with author Michael Gearhartz on his second book, Dark Times.
So, Michael, why don't we start off by you just tell us a bit about yourself. You were born in Germany, but you moved here about 20 years ago, right?
Yes, that's correct. I came to Canada first in 1999, and I met my wife here, and I moved to Canada then in 2000, and I'm here ever since.
Did you come here to work, or...?
No, my first visit to Canada was actually just a vacation. I'm an avid scuba diver, and I really like the waters around Nova Scotia, especially Cape Breton. And while I was here on vacation, I met my wife, and that was basically it. And 6 months later, I was back for good.
For the love of scuba diving, for the love of a good woman, you've made it here.
Since she's listening to this, I think I have to reverse that order. So I got to say, for the love of the woman and the love of the scuba diving.
Yes. So we have you here in the studio because you've just written your second book. It's called Dark Times.
That's correct, yeah.
And it's just old, right? Pretty well.
Yes, it's just over. It took me 3 years to write the second book. Dark Times is a thriller. And I really enjoyed writing it, and I just finished it in January, and it was published on February 1st.
Right. Okay, so now let's, this is your second book. Your first book was called Thin Ice, and that came out a number of years ago, and I believe there's a recurring character in the second book, right?
That is correct. Thin Ice was published in 2012. And Dark Times, it's not a direct sequel of Thin Ice. It's an independent story, but it has the same characters in it.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us a little bit about Natasha as this character?
Yes, Natasha is a marine biologist. She's a young and ambitious woman who tries to make the world a better place as good as she can. In the first book, she's taking the chance of her lifetime going on an international expedition in the Northwest Passage to confirm the human impact on global warming. And but before she knows it, she's going to get caught up in a web of terrorists and greedy politicians, and she has a pretty hard time getting out of it. In Dark Times, things have settled a little bit for Natasha. All she wants to do is living a calm, peaceful life with her husband and former bodyguard and their daughter. But she gets together with her old friends, goes in a diving expedition that leads her underneath an old abbey in England, and she stumbles upon some evidence there that the church does not want to see published. And before she can do anything about it, she's right back into an international web of intrigues and human trafficking and supremacists trying to make the world a better place by fighting terrorism. And her husband and their company, they have a hard time trying to get out of it.
Now, the husband is in the security industry.
He is in the security industry. He used to be her bodyguard, mm-hmm. but they fell in love. Things happen in books. And they are now married, have a daughter, but he's still working for the same security company. And so he has some resources behind him and a good bunch of friends that are going to help him trying to get her back.
So it's intriguing, both these stories and in this everything that's tied up in it, just in what you're telling me here now. Now, I know when you were in Germany, you worked as a police officer for a number of years.
That's
and you
correct.
Work in security now. So
yes.
I take it you sometimes, you're drawing on real life.
Well, it's not a...
Or experiences.
Yes. When I started writing, I wanted to write about something that was realistic, that I could identify with. I was relatively comfortable in writing it, and that only left scuba diving and police, security, executive protection and all that. So I combined both subjects, and that's what reflects in the book. When I was talking to critics about both books, what most of them said that it is really a realistic story. It's not only that the that the heroes or that the villains are realistic. You know, it's they have bills to pay like you and I do. When somebody punches them, it hurts. You know, it's not like they are unrealistic people or like they are superheroes. They are just people like you and I, you know. And that was one of the things that I wanted to make clear with the characters that I developed. When I was reading other books of the same genre, you had one or two heroes that basically had unlimited financial resources, or they could bounce buildings in a single leap and all that. And that's not the way it is, you know. It really isn't. And I want to show that even if you have a character as normal as Natasha, that everything is possible as long as you believe in yourself and if you have the right friends around you that supports you.
Mm-hmm. So it's a fairly large novel, the second one. Did you have how did you go about writing it? Did you have approach it like a plan? I'm going to write a certain number of hours a day or certain number of days a week, or how what's your process?
It was pretty difficult. With the first book that I wrote, it was rather simple. I said, okay, I'm going to write my own book now. And my wife, Susan, who was very patient with me during all that time, said, yeah, you should do that. So she encouraged me. So I turned on the computer and I wrote the first sentence. And then I looked at the monitor for about half an hour and said, okay, what's the second sentence going to be? And that's basically how it started. And I was up to page, I think it was 95 or 100 in that area before I started down scribbling some names. So I did everything totally backwards. With the second book, it was a little bit easier. In the second book, I already knew the characters. I didn't have to create characters. I knew the characters. I knew where they were coming from. I knew their history. I knew their emotions.
Thinking in when you're writing, are you thinking in German phrases or German way of writing things, or is it how does that work? Is there a contradiction going on or a battle between two different languages and trying to put the words down, or does it just come out rather simply?
I would say by now it comes out rather simply. And the first book that I wrote, Thin Eyes, I first wrote it in German. And it was absolutely horrible. When I wrote it in German, I thought, okay, that's my language. That's my strong language. That's my first language. But it is so much more complicated than the English language. And at the end of the day, I didn't like the book. And the critics liked the story about it, but they also didn't like the book that much. And I said, well, okay, if I cannot write it in German, I'm going to write it in English. And that's what I did. And so I rewrote the whole book in English. And while I was rewriting it, I started to recognize that I was thinking in English. You know, every sentence that I prepared in my head was already in English. It was not that I looked at the German sentence and tried to translate it word by word. I was more thinking it through into English and all that. And with the second book, with Dark Times, basically everything was in English right from the get-go. My whole thought process was in English. And I like writing English much, much better than I like German, because for one, I find the English language easier to write. And it gives you much more, I'm going to say, colors to describe something, to describe a story. You know, in German, you are so bound by grammar and by rules and all that. And you do not have that in English. The English language gives you much more freedom to express emotions or to express a certain scene that happens. And I actually find that very interesting to find that out. But if I would ever write another one, it would be in English right from the get-go, mm-hmm. for sure.
Are you thinking of working on another novel? Or? I know this is a lot of work to do.
It is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, I'm more concentrating on promoting this book. Mm-hmm. But Natasha isn't done yet, for sure.
Right.
And if the right idea comes, I will certainly start writing another one.
You're also busy here in Cape Breton. You have a scuba company, right? A dive company, and you take people on tours and that?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that side of yourself?
I became a diver in 1992 in Germany with the German police forces, and I became an instructor in 96. When I came to Canada in 2000, I opened my own dive shop down in the Dundee area, and I started teaching from there, and I had students from all over Cape Breton up down till Truro. And we also took divers out to show them the underwater world of Cape Breton and Nova Scotia in general. And it's quite an interesting place when it comes to historic shipwrecks or history in general. And it's quite beautiful.
Mm-hmm. If you had, let's say, 1 or 2 hours, you had a tourist type that does some diving, but it's never been to Cape Breton, and they only had a short afternoon to go, and they said, Michael, where would you take me? So where would you take the person?
I would probably, if the person is an experienced scuba diver or not. Let's say he is an experienced scuba diver, I would take him to the Iona Bridge in Grand Narrows. The simple reason is you have a very large shipwreck there, about 80 meters long. You have a second shipwreck there that's a little bit behind the first one. And the reason why this place is my favorite place is simply that it shows pretty much the whole North Atlantic fish finder in one place. It is an absolute magnificent diversity of marine life above and below water. And we have marine biologists coming over from all over the world to study that site. And when you're just standing there and looking at it from the surface, nobody has an idea what's really underneath. And I just would show him this to have him understand the beauty of the underwater world, but also to see and help him understanding how important the ecosystem is, and that we have to do something to protect it.
Environmental issues are close yes. to your heart.
Yes.
That comes out in some of the writing, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Especially the first one, it is about the global warming. And the whole story is clouded by the global warming above it. Mm-hmm. The second book, not so much. But yeah, environmental issues are certainly close to my heart.
So you've lived here, well, it's 20 years now, if my math is correct. You see any similarities in, like, between Cape Breton and back home where you came from in Germany, like, you know, cultural or the landscape or things like that?
No, I wouldn't say that I can see any similarities. The landscape here is completely different, and even from the cultural perspective, it's very different in Germany than it is in Canada. And after 20 years in Canada and 25 years in Germany, I can say with confidence that Canada is a very beautiful place to live.
Mm-hmm.
I would not go back to Germany.
Right. You're here for good.
I'm afraid so, yes. You're not going to get rid of me.
Well, you're a very multifaceted and multi-talented person, so I don't think we'd want to be doing that. I've also noticed that you've been nominated for 2019 Indie Book Award. Can you tell me a bit about what that is? Or tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, the Dark Times is nominated for a couple awards. One of them is the Reader's Favorite Book Award for 2019. Another one is the Independent Press Award. We also nominated for the Indie Book Awards and the Independent Publisher Award, which are called the IPPIs. And Dark Times is also a contestant in the 2019 Woolbury Book Award. So that's 5 awards that the book had been nominated for. And from all those, the Independent Publisher Award, which is called the IPPIs, seems to be the largest one. It's the largest international award for independent publishers in English literature. Dark Times has been nominated as Best Thriller.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically like the Emmys or Golden Globes in the book world.
Right, yeah.
So it's a big competition. They say every year there are about 80,000 books entered in that award.
Yeah.
In different categories, but
right.
Nonetheless.
Yeah, so that's terrific. So you'll be finding, we'll be finding out about those later on in the year.
Yes, the Independent Publisher Award, I believe those decisions will be published by the end of May, and the Reader's Favorite Book Award, they will be announced in September or October.
Right. Okay, we'll all keep our fingers crossed for Michael Gerhardt's for those awards. And if people want to meet Michael and hear him read selections from the book, you've got a couple of readings coming up. You want to tell us when they are?
Yeah, we have a couple book readings coming up. The first one will be on Friday, April 5th, right here in Sydney at Dr. Luke's Coffee House.
Yeah.
It's going to happen from 6 till 8 o'clock, and I'm looking forward to see everybody who is interested in showing up. If you cannot make it to that one, we will be in Descous on Saturday, April 6th, from 2 till 4 o'clock, and there will even be a book reading in Antigonish in the library on Saturday, April the 13th, also from 2 till 4 o'clock.
That's terrific. And you'll have a copy of the books with you?
I will have copies of the book with me. And if anybody's interested, you can get the book in every bookstore or online.
Okay. That's terrific. So we've been talking to Michael Gerhardt about his latest novel, really just hot off the press, Dark Times. And we're going to have Michael leave us with, as usually we do with authors here, with one good sentence. And Michael, before you read that, just want to thank you for coming into the Coast and telling us about it, and good luck with it all. And you can leave us with your good sentence.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. So, Shira, let me ask you directly. Brian started and spun around, facing Shira for the second time during this conversation as he continued. Do you want me to pick up that phone and unleash hell?
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.